Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Paul Theroux, whose latest book is titled The Last Train to Zona Verde, My Ultimate African Safari. Paul Theroux has written several books, several travel books, including The Great Railway Bazaar, Old Patagonian Express, Dark Star Safari, several novels, most recently The Lower River and A Dead Hand, a book called The Tao of Travel, which I would like to talk about. But let's first start with The Last Train to Zona Verde. Paul Theroux, Ghost Train to the Eastern Star, at the time I thought that would be your last travel book. Were you planning on the African adventure at that point?
I had always wanted to travel from Cape Town north through Namibia and Botswana. And one of the grails of travel is Angola. I'd always wanted to go to Angola. It's a big, green country that's hard to get into, hard to get out of, off the traveler's map because of 27 years of war. The Portuguese have been there since the 15th century, early 1500s, say 1520. David Livingstone walked across Africa to Luanda, the capital now, and walked back. When he walked back, he discovered, or at least was cited, Victoria Falls and named and described it. So the answer is I had wanted to go back to Africa. I wanted to write about it, and I wanted to go north because I had previously gone from Cairo to Cape Town. So Cairo to Cape Town was a challenge, but I did it overland, and it was what all travel should be, laborious, revealing, enlightening. So although Ghost Train seems like an ultimate book, I suppose, it really isn't. It's a penultimate travel book.
It seemed to me in reading the book that you had originally planned to start in Cape Town and end up in Timbuktu, maybe on multiple trips, but that didn't happen. The book itself, is that one trip? Because I know sometimes you do multiple trips and you'll put them together as one trip.
No, this was one trip. I really intended to go, I mean, in my heart, the itinerary I had was to go into Southwest Africa and Namibia and Botswana, and then get into Angola, then go to the north of Angola, go into the Congo, go to Gabon, Cameroon, Nigeria, and then Burkina Faso, and end up in Timbuktu. Timbuktu is a good destination. You know, it's a fabled city. It's a mythical destination. It's a place that's been on the map for centuries as an ancient metropolis. So I wanted to go there. And then I realized that I couldn't. In a way, not getting there is what this story is about.
It sounded to me as if you had been planning part of the trip with a guy named Kalungu.
Oh, yeah. I met a guy called Kalunga Lima. I met him in Angola. I said, I'm having real difficulty. And I never thought of traveling with anyone before. But he was an African. He's an Angolan. He spoke Portuguese. His English was perfect. His French was okay. And he had a lot of guts. And I said, maybe we could do it together. He's a photographer. And I said, okay. And he said, come back and we'll do it. He was a wonderful fellow, very funny, and a great soul, very energetic. He had a motorcycle, rode around, he made films, he traveled the world. You know, he was someone who worked in the West Indies, had worked in Canada. His father lived in Portugal. He was half Portuguese, half African. So just an absolutely great guy. You'd have to travel very, very far to find someone as nice as he was, as smart as he was, and as adaptable as he was. So I thought, I'll go back and we'll do it together. And then a little time, a couple of months after we made this decision, he died. He had a heart attack. And he was only in his early 40s. That was a blow. That was a blow. He was one of three people that I met on the trip who died. Actually, four, because I subsequently learned, I learned this only about 2 months ago, that a woman that I met in Cape Town, she's named in the book, Vicky. She ran a bed and breakfast in Khayelitsha in a location, a slum really, outside of Cape Town, that she was stabbed to death by her husband. So four people that I met on this trip, I really liked. Kalunga, this woman Vicky, a Portuguese guy called Rui de Camara, and an Australian who was working with elephants in Botswana, all died. And, you know, I got the memo, which was, don't push your luck.
Let's talk a little about the trip itself, Paul Theroux. Okay, so you started in Cape Town, and you'd been there 10 years earlier. You seem pretty optimistic. Things had improved considerably. Some of the makeshift slums had become towns.
Yes, I was impressed that there were aspects of Cape Town that had improved. I should say, by the way, that I'm impressed when I see anything on Earth that's improved, because to me, it seems that the world just gets worse. It's more people, more cars, more roads, less greenery, fewer trees. Cities get bigger. They don't get more beautiful. So to see a place, I mean, it was a location, shantytown, that had been transformed into a viable place where there was water and electricity and houses that didn't leak. That was pretty good. So I was impressed that there was that advance, even modest though it was an advance.
But on the other hand, you go up onto the top of Table Mountain and you look down and you're in nice terrain and there are slums below.
Yeah, that's one of the curiosities of Cape Town. Cape Town is the only city in Africa with a claim to grandeur. It is really a beautiful city. It's big. It has vistas. There's this giant Table Mountain. So from the slopes of it, you can see the ocean, you can see the land swooping off. You know, you can sit in the most salubrious household garden on Table Mountain and think, this is paradise. And then look, and you look down, you see a cloud hovering over one of the biggest slums you've ever seen in your life. So there's that. There's that. It's like a big amphitheater. The groundlings are here, and then there's fine places on the upper slopes.
But then again, you know, where the United States has its slums too.
I'm going to read you the last bit of the book. The last chapter is called, What Am I Doing Here? I knew at last, I'm preparing to leave. On the red clay roads of the African bush, among poor and overlooked people, I often thought of the poor in America, living in just the same way, precariously, on the red roads of the deep south, on low farms, poor pelting villages, sheepcotes and mills, people I knew only from books as I've first known Africans, and I felt beckoned home. The red roads of Africa kind of run into the red roads of the deep south. That's a quote, by the way, low farms, poor pelting villages, and so forth. There's a quote from King Lear. I've subsequently begun traveling in the south, in Alabama, Mississippi, and South Carolina. And there are parts of South Carolina, for example, that look like Zimbabwe. So you're right. We have plenty of poor places here that were facing the same problems.
You went to Namibia and you went on a walking tour with bushmen, though they're called
Juansi.
And then you realized at a certain point that this was an act, that they will change out of their native costumes and put on old T-shirts and shorts, and the old ways are gone.
Yes, not very different from the Wampanoag Native Americans we have on Cape Cod and Martha's Vineyard, Mashantucket, Pequot Indians who might put on deerskin, but the rest of the time they're wearing Tommy Hilfiger. The same is true in Africa. I mean, they're called San people or Bushmen people. Those are very inaccurate and kind of contemptuous descriptions. They have names. They're the Kung people or the Juansi. But they have a history of being hunter-gatherers. They're not hunter-gatherers anymore. They can't be. No one can be. And no one can return to the old ways. They're a benighted people. They're kind of left behind. They're seen as primitive by a lot of Namibians, by a lot of people in general. And they have the same tough time that people have on reservations in the United States, which is they can't continue to live the old life, not any more than the Indians of the plains can kill buffalo and live on old bison, you know, deer meat. But I did meet a couple of old people, one in particular, who still had some of the old knowledge and old stories and, you know, the cosmology of his people. And he was a very upstanding and decent guy. I say he's old. He's probably younger than me. But people age fast in Africa. And, you know, a little old lady is probably 10 years younger than me. And little old man is probably a lot younger than me. Life expectancy is in the, you know, mid to late 30s. So no one gets to be 70 like me. But very few. I was lucky to meet these people, but as you say, it's an illusion to think that they're still subsisting in the old way.
And Namibia itself didn't sound like a particularly appetizing place. Maybe when you got further inland it was beautiful, but it sounded like mostly desert.
It is mostly desert. Namibia is largely desert. It has a population of 2 million people, which is very small, and most of them live either in the capital, Windhoek, or in the north along the border, a few along the coast. It's very thinly populated and always has been. It's desert. As a result, it has a lot of animals. Etosha Park, which is a big waterhole. I mean, basically, Etosha is a salt pan or a sequence of waterholes, has more animals. You know, you'd see more animals there than you'd see in your whole life. Elephants, lions, zebra, everything, kudu, snakes, birds. It's a Garden of Eden from that point of view. They get a lot of tourists there, but it's a small population. It's not a beautiful place. If you like these bleak desert scenes or the Skeleton Coast, it's the coast that runs up to Angola. That is beautiful in a very stark and windswept way.
And then Angola itself, which apparently very few people get in, it sounded to me as I was reading the book, it's a horror.
Yes, Angola is a horror in its own way. I mean, people live there and, you know, God help them. They had 27 years of war and they had everyone contending for their souls. They had the Portuguese, they had the Cubans, they had the South Africans, they had Chinese, they still have Chinese, they had us. 2 million landmines were set down in Angola. They've dug up tens of thousands of them, but there's still plenty there. They have, as a result, no wild animals. The animals have all been eaten or blown up. They have oil, 2 million barrels a day, but the money there goes to just people in the government who are basically keep the money for themselves. The roads are terrible. Officialdom is pretty harsh there. I certainly felt that I was being insulted virtually every time I spoke to someone officially. But the people generally were pretty cheery and they managed. They're just being cheated, like a lot of people in Africa. I suppose you could say a lot of people in the world. They're not well governed. Teachers are underpaid, so no one wants to be a teacher. You need to bribe someone to get your kid into school. So it's tough. But, you know, having said all that, that's the very stuff of what travel is about. You don't really want to go to Deauville or Saint-Tropez and write about it. I don't. I never saw, you know, a book in a salubrious place, the Costa del Sol. You need to see the dangerous edge of things, as Graham Greene once said. So it was a very difficult trip, and it's almost praise to say that Angola's a hellhole, because it's the hellholes of the world that need to be written about and seen and witnessed.
In Tao of Travel, there's a quote, "Remembered misery can produce lyrical nostalgia." Do you feel that way about Angola?
Maybe not lyrical nostalgia, but remembered misery can produce a great story. It's the stuff of travelers' tales. I never felt lyrical, and I never even felt particularly nostalgic, but the memory itself is the memory of having surmounted a lot of difficulties. And sometimes it's the difficulties of your life that are the making of you. You know, someone insults you. Someone says you can't have the job. Someone says, you know, you're no good. You'll have to go away. Your parents say, well, what are you? You're good for nothing. What are you doing? You're just writing all the time. What's it going to add up to? Who's going to publish your work? Who's going to read it? And you say in your heart, I know I've got something. You may not believe in me, but I know it. And then it works. And you think, I overcame that. No one helped me. I'm not saying this is my story, although it's a lot of people's story. Right. Who really helps you? Who knows you? Joseph Smith, the founder of the Mormons, the Mormon prophet, said, "No man knows my history." Joseph Smith actually is the source of some great quotations, but he said, "I'm going to be a sharpened arrow in the quiver of the Lord. And I'm like a great rolling rock, rolling down a hill, having the rough edges knocked off me." So anyway, he said, "No man knows my history." And I think that's true. So Angola was a problem that I had to solve. I didn't have the tourists board helping me. I just was insulted, spat on, hit on, and, you know, people pestering me. And I was thinking at the end of it, what have I got? I've got this great story. Well, that's the thing about traveling alone, is that you need to be alone. You need even to be lonely in order to face whatever you have to face, that you really can't reach out and say, help me, feed me, do something for me. You need really to be in that condition of loneliness, of solitude, in order to discover where it is, where you are and who you are. And that's the stuff of travel.
You're listening to an interview with Paul Theroux, whose latest book is The Last Train to Zona Verde. There's a comment in Tao of Travel. You say you should travel alone or with a small child. Why?
Travel with a Small Child is Dervla Murphy. Dervla Murphy is this tremendous octogenarian Irish woman who has traveled everywhere on an old bike. And she traveled with her daughter. She said that if you travel with a child, people take you into their confidence. They want to protect you. They recognize a mother and child as vulnerable. And she said it's the way of being accepted by a community. I can't imagine traveling with a little kid. First, she traveled alone. And then she traveled with her daughter and went everywhere with the daughter. And she still travels. I mean, she was recently in Palestine. She was in Cuba. She wrote a book about it. She still writes. Dervla Murphy. She wrote a book called Across Ethiopia on a Mule. And she was asked, how did you do that? You know, the Ethiopians aren't that kind to single women. And she said, I didn't travel as a woman. I traveled as a man. I dressed as a man. And people didn't know the difference.
Getting back to Angola, Paul Theroux, there were a few things that astonished me. One was that here is this place that no one really wants to travel in, where the electricity barely works, where everything is pretty filthy, and the prices in American dollars are outrageously high.
Yeah. Yeah, the reason that, the prices are so high are the same reason that prices are high in Dubai and Iran and other places that have oil, that the only people who go there are businessmen and oil people, and they'll pay anything. So they say, I've got to have an air conditioner, and they go, okay, that'll be $500 a night or $800 a night or whatever it is. And the cheapest hotel room I could find was $300 a night in cash in advance until I got out of Luanda. But it's unbelievable. I mean, I would rather face the worst, you know, Motel 6 on earth than a high-priced, crummy hotel in Luanda. And it's peculiar that people want their comforts, but if they're willing to pay for them, then there's no upper limit. Everyone was boasting sort of about how much they paid for things. You know, a loaf of bread cost this, and our apartment is $7,000 a month, and we only have two rooms, and sometimes there's no electricity. And, you know, they're going on like that. That's sort of mildly interesting the first time you hear it. Then you think, why are you putting up with this? Well, they're putting up with it because they're making a lot of money. And it's the oil companies that are doing it. And it's a racket.
But it also means nobody who lives locally can ever afford to buy anything.
That's right. It separates the upper class from an underclass. And so the underclass, which has, you know, no money and no work and no prospects, is so far from, you know, the people going around in Humvees and, or, you know, Hummers and BMWs and big, you know, SUVs. And then there's people just riding bikes or crammed onto buses. So it's rare in the world to see such a division between rich and poor. But, I mean, that's also true in other oil countries and in Nigeria, for example. I mean, Nigeria also pumps 2 million barrels a day, and they have the same division of people with nothing and people with gold bedposts.
Then you start thinking about the future, and you kind of mentioned it's pretty scary because at some point these people could rise up.
Yeah, they'll rise up in the same way that they rose up in Tunisia, in Libya, in Egypt, and other places. I mean, they get angry. And Bahrain was on the verge of that kind of a problem. You see, we do business. Our government does business with unpopular governments. Mubarak. We were trading with Gaddafi. The Tunisian prime minister was very friendly. I mean, he was extremely unpopular in Tunisia. And he had the French going back and forth. And we deal with a lot of unsavory people and don't take into account how angry and how neglected the people in the country may be. And I think we shouldn't be surprised when these people rise up. So it could happen in Africa. It should happen. I mean, if people are discontented, if they're being cheated, why shouldn't they rise up and overthrow their government?
When thinking about the future, one thing that you don't mention, but I kept thinking about as the population explodes and these slum cities get bigger, global climate change could create a great die-off.
That's a very interesting phrase, die-off. Major die-off. There's a book called Straw Dogs. It's by a philosopher called John Gray. It's called Thoughts About Humans and Other Animals. And he describes humans as a plague animal. And he says, like other plague animals, we're destroying our environment. We don't think about what we're doing. We're just like rats nibbling a grain barrel or, you know, just overrunning a rice field. And that we haven't really paid much attention to where we're going. We just assume that we're doing something about climate change, but we're really not. And he said, like other plague animals, we're destroying our habitat. And to use your expression, there will be a massive die-off. Yes, there will be. I mean, anyone with eyes to see, a moron in a hurry, can see that the world is getting more crowded, less beautiful, and more difficult to live in. And that cities, most of the cities, not San Francisco, perhaps not London or New York, but the cities of the world, Sao Paulo, Lagos, Johannesburg, Bombay, Madras, Chennai, you would say, the big cities, the 20 million plus cities of the world, will be unsustainable, and a lot are in China. I don't like to be a futurologist. I have a feeling of what's going to happen, and it's a pretty gloomy feeling, but I don't like to think of it, because my grandchildren, I was thinking the other day, are going to live into the next millennium. My mother's 102. If my grandchildren live to 102, it's going to be 2200.
And they're going to be experiencing the results of the climate change that we're not seeing yet. You know, I just wonder, what's Malawi like now, where you did all your work years ago?
Malawi is a country of 13 million people. 1 million of them are orphans. They're AIDS orphans mainly. So roughly 13% of Malawians are children as heads of household. It has very few trees. It used to have a lot of trees. It used to have people riding bicycles. Now it has overcrowded buses. It's very badly governed. It's not a viable or self-sustainable place. They need help. There are too many people. There's not enough resources to keep the body and soul together. So it's a very difficult place. When I was there, and I first went there 50 years ago, it was a pretty and had a small population, and it looked as though if you solved a couple of basic problems, education, water, roads, it would be a viable economy. It's not now.
Paul Theroux, in the history of Angola, which you go into in the book, in Last Train to Zona Verde, is about Portuguese colonialism. And for me, I just thought colonialism, Portugal, Spain, Germany, more or less the same. But Portuguese colonialism, particularly Angola, was particularly horrifying.
Portuguese colonialism in Africa was pretty horrifying because they didn't send women. They sent mainly men and mainly convicts. Angola was a penal colony almost from the very beginning, almost from the 16th century. They sent out what they called degradados. But it wasn't like Australia where, you know, people were sent to Australia for stealing a bobbin off a loom or picking someone's pocket. You were transported, sent to Botany Bay, men and women. And they were, you know, very petty crimes. They were mainly crimes of hunger and poverty. The criminals who were sent to Angola were wicked, wicked guys. They were poisoners, murderers, rapists. And they became the ruling class, you know, the infrastructure of Angola. And they were slavers. You know, a great number of African Americans in the United States can trace their ancestry to Angola, either via Brazil or directly to the United States. If you're in a cafe in Angola and you want peanuts, you say, "Guba, I want guba, guba, please." The word guba, our word guba, comes from that Kimbundu word, guba. Portuguese colonialism was a racket like all colonial schemes. It was, you know, basically to settle the place, send the worst abroad, and get stuff out of it, get rubber, look for gold, transport the dregs of your society there and somehow make a living at it. So for hundreds of years, I mean, until the first rumbles were in 1961, but the war went on from the 70s onward for 27 years. And it wasn't really settled till in the 90s, you know, when things sort of settled down and everyone was trying to get a piece of Angola. But the place itself was run like the Congo and some other places as a pure racket, just as, you know, there used to be a building in Lisbon which was simply for processing diamonds. And Portugal was prosperous because of its colonies. And, I mean, there was the diamond trade, just get diamonds. There were no roads there. There were no school or very few schools. There were no amenities, but there were diamonds. So they were digging up the place for gold and diamonds. And now there's oil.
When you went in there, in terms of what you might have been expecting, what surprised you the most about Angola?
I was very surprised by the fact that there were no wild animals there. Anyone can assume in Africa that you're going to see an antelope. Antelopes are like deer here. You know, they breed easily. They're all over the place, leaping around. They're kind of, your heart leaps when you see antelopes. Being in a place with no animals, you see a field and you can travel for hours and hours and hours through the bush. And it's real bush. It's Zona Verde, like the title of my book. It's real bush. And you only see mud huts and people. You don't see elephants. You don't see lions. You don't see antelope. You don't, and you think, what the hell? You know, this, you talk about an Eden that's been squandered. I mean, how is it possible? Well, it's the landmines. It was the war. And it's hunger. It's people's hunger. So that's very surprising. I was also very surprised. Generally speaking, Africans are very hospitable, I found. That's a big generalization, but I've never found, I've never felt rejected. But in Angola, I really felt insulted and rejected by anyone in power. Whether it was a policeman, an immigration officer, a tax guy, even to a certain extent, a taxi driver or a politician or someone running a hotel, anyone with power, you get the impression they want to kick you in the teeth. They've obviously been kicked in the teeth themselves. I mean, people behave that way when they've been treated badly. So I'm Paul Theroux. Yeah, I'm not going to say, do you know who I am? But I think I represent what we used to call a Mzungu, a white man. And or a foreigner in East Africa. And I thought, they see me as an exploiter. They see me as an oppressor. They see me as someone that made their lives miserable, as the soldiers did, South African soldiers, Cuban soldiers. So I'm paying that price. But that's something to write about, isn't it? I mean, that if they had just put out a red carpet, as they do at the national airport, there's nothing to write about.
I'd like to ask you about Tao of Travel. What prompted you to put together a book of quotes and your own thoughts on travel and travel books?
All my traveling life, and I'd say I first published a travel book, The Great Railway Bazaar, in 1975. Since then, people have said, what travel books do you read? Where would you like to go? Who's your favorite travel writer? What are your favorite places? You know, it's a very frustrating thing. You know, you can name your 10 favorite movies, but try to name 10 favorite books. I would say, ask me my 300 favorite books, and I'll make a list of my 300 favorite books, okay? If you've read 20 books, you can name 10 books. If you've read thousands of books, and you have, and I have, and loved hundreds of them, and also, I read with a pencil. You know, I mark off things. You come across something that's felicitous. And I think, I've never read that before. That's good. That's a memory. It goes into my commonplace book. I was thinking, how can I pull all this together? Favorite foods of travel, favorite routes. People who didn't get it. You know, writers who wrote about foreign places like Saul Bellow or Franz Kafka or Edgar Rice Burroughs. You know, writing books about Africa or America or whatever it is, and they never went there. You know, you think, oh, there's a category. Or people who get it wrong. Or books with a sense of place that you know aren't that popular, that no one's really heard of, like Christ Stopped at Eboli by Carlo Levi. That kind of book. And then, you know, favorite books, favorite quotes. And I thought, I want to bring them all together. So I thought The Tao of Travel was an ideal format for it. It's a personal anthology. And to compile the book, I reread hundreds of books. There are about, I don't know how many books are quoted in it, 200 or 300, I think. But I remember that I made repeated trips to the University of Hawaii library. I used to come back with 15 or 20 books in a big bag every week. And I just, you know, reread and made quotes. I did it all myself. I do not have an intern. I do not have a graduate student. I did all the typing myself. I did all the photocopying myself. I was thinking, God, I'd love to be an English prof and have, you know, say, Tiffany, Daphne, Neil, Jason, I want you to go photocopy this. But I didn't. I did it all myself. So it's a compilation of what I value in travel and reading generally.
You make a statement. If you're going to be an interesting traveler and want to go somewhere, use guidebooks to find areas most frequented by foreigners, then go in the opposite direction.
You want to try to make your own discoveries. It's hard enough on Earth to find a place that hasn't been visited. But you can find places that are thinly visited. You know, those are the places to go. My general rule is leave home, leave your family, go away. It's what Jung calls individuation. Just go and find yourself and find why you're on Earth. People will say, well, where should I go? Oh, we had a wonderful trip to Tuscany. Go to Tuscany. Well, everyone goes to Tuscany, or even, you know, Rio de Janeiro or Florida or, I don't know, Portland, Oregon. Avoid those places. I mean, go to a place. What about Romania? What about, I don't know, Somalia? maybe avoid Somalia. You know, a lot of people say, don't go to India, you'll get sick. I would say, no, go to India. Yeah, you'll probably get sick, but you'll have an interesting time.
You might eat fly-covered chicken. There's a sequence where this woman sold you this blackened, gross chicken with flies on it.
That chapter you're referring to is called Three Pieces of Chicken. It's one of my favorite chapters. It's sort of object lesson in travel, where I was in a car that was defunct, and we got stuck in the bush. The guys in the car all got drunk, and they were just sitting around. And I was sitting there as the sun was setting, and an old woman, I say old, she was probably younger than me, came over and said, I said, what have you got in the bucket? And she said, frango. Frango's chicken. I looked at the three pieces of chicken in the bottom of the bucket covered with flies. And I said, no, I don't want that. And I waved away. No, I said, no, thanks. Obrigado. I don't want it. And then as she was walking away, I was thinking, and what's my backup plan? What's plan B? Paulie, I don't really have one. There's nothing else to eat it. So I called her back and I said, I'll have that one. Oh, I remember. She's had the tongs. She said, which one? So someone throws you a bucket with three pieces of chicken all covered with flies. Which one? You know, that's great, man. That's Woody Allen. Which one? I said, okay, that one, the one with the fewest number of flies on it. And then I took it. I started a fire. I killed the germs. I don't know whether I really killed the germs. I must have. I didn't get sick. And I ate it. And then the next day she came back and I was hungry and she said, which one? Only two pieces of chicken, but the same number of flies. So there, of course, there were a lot of flies, but only two pieces of chicken. And I said, okay, I'll have which one had that one. And then she comes back again. I don't want to spoil a good story, but it's three pieces of, but while I was there eating the three fly blown pieces of chicken, there was a ceremony called the Efundula ceremony. It's a nobility ceremony was going on. And that was, I was very fortunate to be a witness to this ceremony, to see it was girls being initiated into womanhood and their marriageability. And so you could say, well, oh, that's disgusting. You're going to get sick and three pieces of chicken with and all the flies and it's really dirty and there's nowhere to sleep and it's horrible and dusty and disgusting. It was all those things, but it was also an enlightenment. So in order to see what I saw, I had to eat three pieces of chicken. So that stands in my mind as a set of epiphanies. And then I thought afterwards, well, I'm going to write about that. And I kept thinking of it, of the woman saying with the tongs, she's holding a bucket full of flies and a pair of tongs and saying, which one? And I thought, in a way, that's the metonymy of the travel dilemma.
Paul Theroux, most of your novels feature as a protagonist you in a disguised form. Why do you do that?
I don't know whether it is me in a disguised form, but I think that a writer only has himself or herself to deal with. You just have your own little self. So the protagonist will be a version of you. In A Dead Hand, there's a character called Jerry Delfont. Jerry is in Calcutta. He's having his experience of Calcutta. He meets an older woman who's into tantric massages, and he has, you know, a thrill up his leg there. About halfway through the book, he sees a guy from the consulate there, and he says, Paul Theroux's coming. And I thought the reader has to say, what? I thought he was writing this book. And then you see me, and it's a version of me in the book. So you say the protagonists are like me, but I put myself in the book under my own name. I'm kind of an irritating, semi-boastful, chippy traveler, cautious about what he says, teasing in a way. And that's me in the book. That's sort of the received version of me, kind of an irritating person. But you realize Jerry's not me, and that's why I put it in, because the people in my books aren't me. I suppose they're a little bit like me in some ways, but in other ways, significantly not. I like to think that I'm creating characters, not just writing about myself.
It felt to me in the ones that I've read that it's you, but alternate versions. They're not you, and yet there's enough of you, travel writer. I mean, I could see Paul in them, and in a couple of cases they're actually called Paul Theroux. I mean, you're not disguising that.
No, that's true. One of my favorite novels that I've written myself is called Picture Palace. It's a very early book. I published it in 70, probably 77, 78. Maud Pratt is a photographer. I think of Maud Pratt, she's an older woman, takes pictures, and she's funny. She's lived a very full life as a photographer. And I think of her as a very autobiographical figure. So you can write about yourself as a little old lady, as a man, as a boy, in a lot of forms. I admire people who can create a completely different character. But the older you get, I mean, the harder it is to get away from who you are. And you also, I think, need somehow to memorialize who you are, because no one else is me. So no one else has had my experience. So if I'm creating a character or recreating a character like myself, I'm putting this reality down on paper. I realize I'm contradicting what I said earlier about making someone new. But also, I've been a witness to, you know, I'm over 70 years old. I've been a witness to a great deal of 50 years ago, I went to Africa, 1963. So for 50 years, I've been looking at Africa, and I think it's worth writing about whether I write about myself as a traveler, as I've done in Dark Star Safari and Last Train, or fictionalized in the Lower River. The character's not me. He hasn't had exactly my life, but he's had my witness. And I think that the Lower River is a very authentic book about the African experience, about a guy being held hostage in a village. I mean, that to me is a very vivid, gripping story, if I do say so myself. And he's a bit like me. He has some of my opinions, but not all of them.
When you were doing the Zona Verde trip, were you working on that book, on Lower River?
Yes. I should say that the Lower River is a story about a man whose life is turned upside down. His wife leaves him. His daughter turns out to be a bit of a pain. His business folds. He's retained. He says, well, I'm going to go back to the only place that I was ever happy, this village in Africa. And he goes back, and he brings money with him, and thereby hangs the tale. But I've written versions of this story ever since I was in Africa. I mean, I had a very early experience in 1960, in the Christmas 64, 65, the winter of 64, 65. I was in Zambia, and I was in a bar, and I went home. I remember I said to a guy and a woman in a bar, have a drink, and would your wife like a drink? He said, no, we'll have a drink, but it's not my wife. It's my sister. And Buona, she likes you. I said, Merry Christmas. So we had a drink. I went home with them. Thereby hangs a tale. I went home with them, and the next morning I said, that was pretty amazing. And I yawned. I said, I got to go. And they said, no, you can't leave. We're going out for a drink now. I said, it's 8 o'clock in the morning. And they said, no, we're going for a drink. And I went. And for the next 3 days, they stayed drunk. And I tried to get as drunk as possible to keep up with them. They wouldn't let me go. And to me, that's the story. That's the story of my time in Africa. That to me is, it became a mythical story. I mythologized it perhaps, but it seemed to me to embody everything that I felt in Africa, that you go there with the best of intentions, have a drink. It's not my wife, Bonna. It's my sister, and she likes you. And you say, it's fabulous. And the next morning they say, no, you can't leave. And actually I had to escape. And it's a long story of how I got away, but it was a terrifying experience. I've written about it maybe four times in different stories, in different contexts. But the Lower River is the ultimate. That's using all that emotion and making it into something. I must say that later in life you have fewer and fewer new ideas. But that was one that came to me that I fulfilled. And I'm very happy with that as a novel.
When you're on your travels, do you feel like when you're, you know, you sit there and you're scribbling and, my God, you're traveling on these buses for hours and you're writing, is that a time when you are writing novel? Is that a time? What are you writing in those periods?
When I'm traveling, I'm writing notes about the trip, period. Yeah, period. I might be toying with a story. I mean, you know, at night, I might have a story on the go. It will be a pretty simple story. It's one that I'm just turning over in my mind to keep me contented, to keep my imagination going. I've done it. I mean, when I wrote Dark Star Safari, I was working on a story called The Stranger at the Palazzo d'Oro, because I met a guy on a Nile cruise. He was an Egyptian, and he was with four German women, all blonde, all identical. They weren't friendly to me at all, but they all looked the same. They all looked around 60 years old, but they could have been 55, sort of brittle, but rather attractive and platinum blonde. They had the same face. We were talking and I said, what do you do for a living? He said, I'm a doctor in Germany. I said, what kind of doctor are you? He said, I'm a cosmetic. I do cosmetic surgery. And these are, these women are Germans and they wanted to see Egypt and they're my client. They were my patient. They were my clients. He made them look all the same. And I thought, God, that's a great story. That I want to write that story. I want to write the story of a plastic surgeon who has created this youthful but distant woman. And so the Stranger at the Palazzo d'Or is a story about a young man, me, you could say, a me type, ambitious, and it's set in the Italy of 1962 and 3, which I knew pretty well. I was there then. I was working on that story all the way through Africa. Just a story. It's not a novel. It's a novella. I love it. The Stranger at the Palazzo d'Oro. But the germ of it came on that Nile cruise. And after the Nile cruise, I kept thinking about it. When I was traveling in the last train to Zoda Verde, I was thinking of the lower river. Yeah. I was thinking of it because I felt sort of captive myself. It gives you something, you know, if I'm not writing something, I'm reading something. And, you know, I might be reading Muriel Spark or something like that. But it's just something as a relief, as a refuge from the daily grind.
Were you reading books or tablets or?
Books, not tablets. I don't carry any recording devices or computer or, I had a $20 cell phone that I bought in South Africa. That was it really. I bring books, I read them, and then I give them away. Or I leave them in hotel rooms.
At the end of Zona Verde, we leave you in Luanda. How did you get out? Did you get on a plane in Luanda?
I got on a plane and I flew to Cape Town and then I stayed in Cape Town for a while. I was waiting for the word from Kalunga Lima and then I heard the news that he died. Then I thought, well, this is over. This trip is over. I'm not going to pursue this anymore.
At that point, your monetary situation, somebody had stolen your identity and you had to pay cash. Was the ticket that took you back to Cape Town, was that bought in South Africa before you left?
Yes. I had a ticket, a round-trip ticket. This is really complicated, the ticketing, because I had a ticket from Cape Town, New York, to Dubai, to Cape Town, and then back. And I basically adapted that ticket, but I had to pay cash for that. It was very, very complicated, and my identity was stolen in Namibia. My advice to anyone who goes to Africa is pay cash. Don't show anyone your credit card. Identity theft is rife in the world, and you can go to the smallest, happiest-looking little dusty town in Africa, and someone could steal your identity. My identity was stolen, and my bill were in the tens of thousands of dollars. Tens of thousands of dollars. They bought furniture, cars, computers, everything. I saw the list of things that had been bought in my name. A tuna fish sandwich at one place and $4,000 worth of furniture in another place. They never found anyone. I think it was, might have been an inside job. I don't know. But I wasn't charged by the company. They was liable for it. You know, they weren't asking for an ID or anything. They were just using the card. But people can actually make a copy of your credit card and use it.
Paul Theroux, you've written this book and Lower River has just come out in paperback. What are you working on now?
I'm not working on a book at the moment. I'm traveling in the South. I realize over the years, over the past, I don't know, 10 years, 15 years, written enough short stories to fill a very thick volume. So probably my next book, if I can interest my publisher in it, it will be a book of short stories. I've published a lot of them in magazines. Some have won prizes. In terms of a project, I've been traveling in the South. Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, South Carolina. I would like to see Louisiana. I'd like to see Arkansas. I'd like to see the parts of the South that resemble the parts of the Third World that I've been in. And the resemblance is uncanny.
You've been listening to an interview with Paul Theroux, whose latest book is The Last Train to Zona Verde, My Ultimate African Adventure, and The Lower River, his novel, is just out in paperback. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.